Looking into the text that we have read today, I cannot help but think that wherever it seemed Jesus went, there always seemed to be this rattling of the religious establishment. As we have gone through thus far, and we are just now getting into really the life of Jesus, the ministry of Jesus, already he is rattling the religious establishment. It seemed that no matter what religious tradition one hailed from, no matter a person's denominational persuasion, Jesus always seemed to shake them up. In many ways, I think that Jesus was the antithesis of religious course. And we don't think of him that way. We think religion and Jesus being synonymous, but it wasn't really so. In fact, it seemed that Jesus was going against the powers that be, the religious course of that day. Jesus was always a constant challenge to the status quo. The redirect away from pious dogma and toward an interactive relationship. Now, I need to emphasize that doesn't mean this cliched personal relationship with God that we hear so much about in the greater church community today. Because that phrase, frankly, is found nowhere in Scripture. And that, in fact, so often when we say personal relationship with Jesus, what we really mean is an adjustable relationship with Jesus. One where I can operate my Christianity like a spiritual dimmer switch, and I can just adjust the level of discipleship to a comfortable level. No, our relationship with Christ, while it is personal, is to be innately and biblically a group relate. And we've lost that in our generation, but it is a biblical fact. Our relationship with Christ must be played out in a corporate participation. And that bar is a spiritual manifest that is firmly and forever set by the example of Jesus Christ as we read through the Gospels here. Indeed, as I've said, my relationship with God absolutely is deeply personal. But that is in as much as it means that I am personally responsible, I am individually initiating that relationship. The bottom line, again, is that my Christian life is to be lived out in a local community. A community of believers, a local church. And my gifting then lived out in the corporate unity, the body of Christ with others. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. That's not a Jesus Fellowship position alone. It is a scriptural position. I encourage you to read through the Gospels. Read Acts, the early church. Read the epistles. The New Testament is absolutely emphatic. There's no place for the Rambo Christian. Our direct toward the relationship we have vertically, as well as what we are to have horizontally as a church, is uniquely and intrinsically by the hand of Jesus Christ. Faith, therefore, must always be, by his design, more than just church on Sunday. And for many of us, that's the beginning and the end of it. Our relationship with Christ starts somewhere around 10 o'clock on Sunday, and by 12:30, it's over until next week. But that's not a biblical Christianity. That's modern religion. It is to be an all-encompassing lifestyle wherein we are called now to live for kingdom pursuit and for the glory of God. There was then, as there are now, plenty of folks who were lost, I guess I would say, in the elements of religion, the orthodoxy, the trappings of church. And yet, again, then and now, these same people fail to come to a real understanding of what it means to be rather than just do. There are those who know the rules. They knew through which hoops to jump to fulfill their quota, and maybe that's why you're here today. Just trying to square things up with God. Don't know about that hell thing, but don't want to risk that. These people had not come to know God in a walk beside me kind of way. These folks, both then and now, they tend to bristle when they see people walk in grace and freedom. And if you've run into one of these people, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, you are more than just an enigma to them. You can actually irritate them through the exercise of your grace. We began with the disciples of John coming to Jesus and saying, hey, hey's in there, it's implied, okay? Hey, why do we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast? Now, I don't suppose to put anything in the text that is not here. I think when the Bible is silent, we should be silent. However, in my personal life, and I'm just sharing my own personal views here for whatever they're worth, I can't help but hear a verbal tone here in which the question was asked. And if history bears it out, and the choice of words tells us anything here, I can't help but think that there was at least a touch of inner angst here in these guys. I mean, these boys were coming from, by their own words, the position of fasting often, quote unquote. So, I don't know, I can't help but perhaps hear a private subliminal voice beneath the public voice that's kind of saying, what's the deal? I mean, we're over here doing all the stuff we're supposed to be doing, and you guys aren't. How do you guys get away with that? And again, maybe some uptight believers that you've met in the past kind of said the same to you in so many words. Now, Jesus, before he goes into a lengthy explanation, he does briefly acknowledge that the day of fasting for his disciples would indeed come. But he's saying at this point, communion at this time was more crucial than contrition and duty. And you know what? Communion always is more important than contrition and duty. Yet it was what he would say next, I think, that perhaps would come across as maybe out of context. If you don't just follow Jesus as he goes along here, you can start to see the Gospels as being a whole bunch of little snippet stories. And while he does indeed change locations and change maybe topics, but many of these stories are deeply connected, and you need to read them in that way. Jesus here was simply elaborating an explanation of the heart behind the difference of the living of his disciples in contrast to other religious folks. He was now merely going to play out the truth behind the answer to the question of why? Why? The fact is, both then and now, and at really every age in between, there has always been those individuals who, I guess I would use the term, get stuck. Those who can, on demand, contextualize the walk of faith. I mean, they can recite from memory all the rules and all the regulations. They can quote John 3:16. They know all the do's. They know all the don'ts. But they can't seem to grasp, put their mind and arms around the bigger picture. They never move beyond that stiff and mechanical practice of religion. They can't actually get that embrace going of the actual practice of loving Jesus. And if you're one of them, let me tell you right now, it shows. It shows. Eventually, in 25 years of ministering, I have found that these folks always burn out. You can keep going like that for a little while under your own mo, but not for very long. Sooner or later, no matter how tough you are, you're going to burn out. Because these people, having never found the point of this Jesus thing, they invariably fall away in the absence of substance. The lack of meaning behind what they are doing under the umbrella of faith. So they're just, they never get it. They're like, what does this all mean? So Christianity fails to fulfill them. I would say more likely they failed Christianity. But either way, The living of Christianity fails to bring them peace, fails to bring them purpose. All the stuff they read about in the introductory flyer, it just didn't happen for them. I remember, I've had people tell me that, look me in the eye and go, it just doesn't work for me, Pastor. So they cash in their chips. They bow out of the game and head it on back to from wherever they came from before the game got started. The Bible warned this. They said, a dog returning to its vomit. Now, if you've ever had a dog, you know what I'm talking about. It always reminds me. I see that and I'm like, yeah, I guess that's biblical. What a waste of time. I'm astonished. I mean, I've seen these folks dump time in the measurement of not just years, but decades. Decades. How do you throw away decades? I mean, I personally don't have that kind of loose change in my life, especially at this age, so I'm compelled to get it right the first time. There's no do-overs for me, not at this age. So Jesus, now he paints a picture through story. Not two subjects, still carrying on. He paints a picture through story of an unshrunk patch sewn on to cloth that is already used and worn. Now, I get that. And if you know me, you know that I am an avid old school Levi's man. I've left very few instructions after I die. One of them is I told Sharon, I lived in Levi's. You will bury me in Levi's, okay? I'll be the only one in heaven. If you get them over, I'll be the hot thing, man. Nice threads, man. So I understand this. So when I have a pair of Levi's and they're all broken, and if you're a Levi's guy, you know what it was like. It's just like you get them, they're perfect. Okay, you got it. They're soft, they're comfortable, and they can take just about anything you throw at them. I mean, you can beat them, and they keep going. But one thing they don't take well is a piece of cloth that is still young being sewn onto them. Because the old doesn't play well with the new. The new will move and shrink, and the old will not. The hole will just tear open, and it'll be worse than it was before. So in order to patch the hole, one must find old material to sew on to old jeans. And I know this, and so does my wife. She does the sewing. Jesus here clarifies his analogy with the picture of the foolishness of putting new wine in old wineskins. Now, an old wineskin becomes brittle with age. See, they would take new wine, they would put it in these, and they were usually made out of the skins of animals. They'd put them in these new skins, and then when the wine would begin to ferment, it would expand, and so would the wineskin. So what he's saying is the old wineskins, they had become brittle with age. They no longer had the ability to flex with pressure and flex with change. And that new wine, if it's in there, is going to start to ferment. And when it does, it's just going to blow up the wineskin because there's no give left in it. Let me tell you something, a little glimpse into my world. Understanding this reality of what's being presented here is the tightrope walk of a church shepherd. How does one savor the qualities and those subtle nuances of a fine classic aged wine at the same table that has iced cups of Boone's Farm? Okay? Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about there, that's okay. But, I mean, you have to understand that when you're ministering to the diversity of age groups that we have here, that's kind of where I'm at. I mean, I've got, you know, a $50 bottle of Chianti over here imported from Italy, and I got a bunch of, you know, screw-off Boone's Farm over here, too. So, how does one manage the needs and the nuances of the old and the new? Jesus got it. He understood. These boys that were with Jesus, they were new vintage boys. In fact, they had had it right up to their ears with orthodoxy religion that required them to do things that they never could do. They never could pull it off, and it didn't change their lives. It was just religion. Every new generation always seems to reinvent itself with new techniques and new methods, and the Christian world's no different. I mean, it doesn't mean we abandon the gospel or alter what is the inalienable truth of Christ. It just means that things are going to look different sometimes and sometimes act different while maintaining a fundamental and crucial aspect of scriptural faith. Jesus had and has, even to today, this unique ability to roll with the generations. The changes that always come. Now, few of us, I think, are as capable as that. But I might interject at this point, and it's a little bit of a sidebar in this message, but listen, it's very important that if you cannot bend, Christian, that you are able to step aside and make room for the next gen of Christian individuals. They got to be able to find their feet. If you're an older believer here, that's just love. That doesn't mean you sit on your behind and do nothing. It just means you roll with the changes. If we're unwilling, what's going to happen is we're just going to continue to kill off so much of another generation because we want things our way. The old way, of course. And then the new tears the old, and sometimes it just simply blows it up. For these boys, the issue was fasting. For me, in my world, it was hymns, Sunday evening church, which I swore since I was a pastor. Never, okay? Suits, ties, Sunday school. Ah, Sunday school just makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. But now there's a new gen of believers out there, and they got piercings, and they got tats, and they got Christian rap, and they got Bible study and pubs and radical mission lifestyles. Praise God. So believer, before I move on, make up your mind here today to step back or step up, because they're coming through whether you want them to or not. This church will always cater to them. So if you're an older believer and you need to be front and center, wrong church. But I do wonder about this church. We've existed now for over a couple decades. Time flies and you're having fun, huh? What does it say about this church, about our days ahead? Will we continue to embrace the future, or will we hide in the wine cellar and grow old? What will it take to keep us focused and pliable? And I believe the answer to that last question is here in the text. Because as Jesus was talking to these guys, he was speaking these things. Example A approaches stage left. A man came to Jesus saying that his daughter had just died or was dying and was asking that Jesus come and lay hands on her. And that he believed that if Jesus would do that, the girl would live. And let me tell you something, I need to make it up front as I approach this story today. On the surface, there's nothing wrong with his request. In fact, I think it expressed great faith. If you lay hands on her, man, she'll be healed, she'll live. And I think that kind of faith so often comes only through years of aging. Or at least it should, older believer. It only comes through that, you know, that slow aging process, slowly but surely developing in us an exquisite flavor and great value. But I want you to notice, please, today, the man's approach. Careful looking at the text, notice that he says to Jesus, "Jesus, come." Now, Jesus didn't complain. Jesus never complains despite our unruly behavior towards him. In fact, he just got up and he headed out. But please notice the woman who's entering stage right had a much different approach. Hers was rather to go to him. In her mind, you see, she was broken and she was unclean and she was unworthy to approach the Messiah. Understanding Jewish culture and history certainly explains her thinking. Because the best commentary evaluation sees that the language here is understood to tactfully tell us that this woman had possibly been menstruating for 12 years. Try to wrap your mind around that, ladies. A 12-year period. She was beaten down. She was worn out. And in that culture, she would have been absolutely ostracized and isolated. She wouldn't have been able to have communion with others, likely no family or possessions. Because of religion, she could not be with everybody else. She was unclean, ceremonially unclean, because of religion. She would have been like a leper in that day, unclean and not welcome. But this woman was desperate. Maybe you've been there. And the one thing that comes out of desperation is it moves you, don't it? Again, there was nothing intrinsically wrong with the man's request for Jesus to come. But you see, there's a heart behind our approach to Jesus, even today. And that heart says so much about who we are and what we are. It says volumes about whether we are old wineskins or new. It says whether we become easy and comfortable in our age or whether we have remained new and flexible and can still bend. It says whether we are soft and satisfied in our relationship this morning with Jesus or whether we're still hungry. Whether we're still motivated, we're still desirous to be where Jesus is and where it's going down. This woman felt unworthy, and she longed to just touch the hem of his garment. Now, another of the Gospels accounts say something wonderful and staggering. Not in the text we read today, but in the movie it reflected to this. It records that at the moment the woman touched him in the crowd, Jesus stopped and turned and asked, "Who just touched me?" Now, there's a few passages in Scripture. Man, they just make my knees weak when I think about this, and this is one of them. The apostle said, "Master, the crowd's pressing up on you. How can you ask who touched you? Everybody's touching you." And Jesus said, "No, you don't understand. Someone touched me, and I know it because the power just left me." Just dwell on that for a minute. It was so tangible, he knew that it had happened. I mean, that is an absolutely awesome thing for me there. I mean, I do not pretend to understand it, but as long as I always experience the effect of it, I'll just keep going to Jesus for that mojo. No problem. Again, do I grasp it? No. But I know one thing, that it's that kind of ideal that makes me always pray to God and hope that I'll always be that hungry. I'll always be that expectant to go to Jesus, that needy, that I will be driven to make my way through the crowd to Jesus no matter what. Now, if there's a difference between these two souls' way to Christ, it would have been their approach. Jesus loved them both. He answered both of their requests. There was no animosity, no anger here. It was not on Jesus' side, it was on the people's side. And how they went towards Jesus, the difference was their approach. One wanting Jesus to go with him, and the other came to Jesus. One wanting Jesus to come and do his thing in his world, and the other came to where Jesus was working and moving and sought to catch some of the overflow. What's your method of approach this morning? Are you looking for Jesus to get on board with what you got going on? Are you looking for Jesus to come with you to do what you want him to do? Or are you just looking for wherever Jesus is working and getting on that train? Because you just hunger to be near him, to be up close to where that kind of power, that kind of tangible power is being manifested. Mark and Luke's account of this says this man's name is Jairus. Now Jairus, he was the leader of the synagogue. The synagogue was the center of religion in his day. So Jairus would have had a lot of responsibilities. He would have been the man supervising the worship services, and he would be caring for the scrolls and running the daily school, keeping the congregation faithful to the issues of the law. He would be in charge of distributing the alms and administering the care of the building and finding rabbis to teach on the Sabbath. He would have absolutely been a man of great influence in his community. He would have had to have been a real type A kind of guy. He was a leader. The kind of guy who gets things done, the kind of guy who makes things happen. So you see, Jairus, he would have had years, if not a lifetime, of directing others. That was just his MO. However, we know that his approach to Jesus now, it was anything but condescending. Scripture presents a very humble heart in Jairus here as he knelt before Jesus, showing great respect, great reverence for Jesus. So I need to point that out because I don't want you to think that what I'm alluding to here today is that Jairus was anything but gracious and subservient to Jesus. Jairus was desperate, but was he hungry? He wanted Jesus to do something for him, but was he coming to give himself wholly to Christ? To surrender his life to the Master? The carpenter's son from Nazareth? Nothing in this story gives us that picture. The life of Jairus possessed, I guess, the attributes that would have fostered the old wineskin life of comfort and religious status quo. Why push my luck? Why push the envelope? Why venture out into uncharted ground? You know, at my age, I'll just kind of kick back and I'll just ride this right on into heaven. An older saint, if you're here today, I got to tell you, that's disgusting. Shame on you if you're holding that kind of ideal. There's still so much to do. And God still wants to wow you. His life was one of religious practices and rules and regulations. Restraint and rigidity would have been the norm for him. Jesus had been previously approached by a man of power. Maybe you remember the story. The centurion in the military. Do you remember this guy? Now this guy, he remarked to Jesus, he said, "Look, I'm a powerful man in this world. I tell people to go and they go, and I tell people to come and they come. But I do not deserve to have you even come under my roof, Jesus." So he went on to say, "Jesus, just say the word from here, and my servant who is sick will be healed back home." That guy grasped the situation, didn't he? His approach to Christ presented a picture that says he clearly knew the score. So Jesus, you know, in that story, he healed a servant long distance. So we know he easily could have done this. But Jairus said, Jesus, come. So the centurion's heart was very different than this man's. The woman, on the other hand, would have been coming from the opposite end of the spectrum. She was, and she had nothing. She had no clout, she had no influence, no comfort, no power over anyone or anything. She was just simply a lost soul. She was not part of the local tabernacle. No Sabbath services for her. She couldn't be with other believers. So all of the religious bureaucracy meant absolutely nothing to her. She didn't care. What was proper didn't hold sway to this woman. In fact, understand, she consciously broke the rules getting to Jesus. She knew she wasn't supposed to be there. A person labeled ceremoniously unclean, as she would have, she should not have been in that crowd that day. She was expected to stay away from all the good people. She wasn't to engage them in any way. But she no doubt clandestinely made her way through the crowd. Would have loved to have seen it. Why? Because she had to get to Jesus. That's all there was to it. I don't care about the rules. I don't care what's proper. I don't care how many feathers we ruffle. If I can just get to him, I'll be healed, she thought. If I can just touch his robe, I'll be healed. I'm reminded of the blind men who, in Matthew 20, they called out to Jesus from the side of the road. They yelled out to Christ. They couldn't even see him, but they heard he was coming, and so they started yelling. Why? Because they had nothing to lose. They were blind, and they knew it. There was no consideration of what was proper or what the religious rules of etiquette were here. They just knew two things, that they were blind and Jesus could fix it. That's all that mattered. And if you want the simplest rendition of the gospel out there, you're blind and Jesus can fix it. Jesus did fix it. So they yelled out above the crowd. Again, I love to have seen it. The text of that story tells us that the people tried to get them to shut up, and it just made them yell louder. They weren't hampered by decorum or protocol. They just had to get to Jesus. And then in Luke 17, there was the 10 lepers. They saw Jesus coming, but they would have been held back by the rules again. Religious rules that say a leper can't approach a non-leper. The 10 would have been absolutely, unconditionally stoned to death if they had tried to break from the crowd and make a run for him. So they yelled. They just yelled with all their might, Jesus, help us! And Jesus healed all of them on the spot. And he told them to go and to prove their healing to the priests at the temple. Normal practice for that day. But out of the 10, there was the one. There's always the one. Like this woman. The one who realized he was healed, and he turned and ran back to Jesus, praising God, and he fell at the feet of Jesus. And Jesus said, where's the other 9? They're gone. But the one guy who, if you read the story, who was not just blind, he was, or not just a leper, he was an outcast Samaritan. Social outcast. He came back to the feet of Jesus because he no doubt understood that he was nothing and Jesus was his only hope. It's very important for us, Jesus Fellowship. It's a good time for us to take a look at ourselves. We're moving into a new year. And most of you, you don't remember the storefront days with white plastic chairs. You don't remember when our coffee was in the back room and came out of a, I know, God forbid, a percolator. I know, it's criminal. It's criminal. I could be hauled into the Hague anytime over that issue. You weren't here when there was 20 of us. When our missions endeavors solely encompassed one GFA guy in India who we never met. We just sent him monthly support. The whole church, one guy. Now, besides all the mission stuff we do, which is huge, there's 48 students being sponsored monthly out of this group right here. Every month. Not to mention keeping the corporation running over there and paying teachers and building churches. We've built 5 in the other direction in another country, which will remain nameless. So you don't remember. But it's very important for us always to just be able to take a step back and look. And it's so critical, Christians, that we always are the individuals and the church that strives to be that unshrunk piece of cloth. That we are new wineskins. The ones who, understanding we are nothing, will always seek to get to Jesus, always seek to just touch the hem of his garment, knowing that if we ever even get that, that we are greatly blessed. We deserve death, Christian. And here we are. I mean, it's not like we wanted them, but we have stained glass windows. How did that happen? We got real pews, so we're a real church, apparently. May we forever be people that does everything in our power to get hungry people to Jesus. And we don't play religious games. We don't hold to stupid traditions. To go out and find the blind and the leprous, the ones who are standing alongside the road, outside of the crowd, shouting to Jesus. Those who are sneaking through the crowd, may we always be the ones sneaking through the crowd, trying to get to the one who can heal. Because those people, they are us. They are us. And may we never forget. As we come to close today and look into the new year, it's always important for us to know who we are. If you're a guest here today, I welcome you. If you want to know who we are, we have written material. We can talk to you and tell you who we are. I can appreciate if you're looking for a family to belong to, a community to belong to. But I hate the term church shopping. We're not a commodity. And what are you looking for? Comfort? Amenities? Ease, comfort, convenience? Catch one of the pastors afterwards. We can direct you to a church in town that will give you those things. But we are not it. It has always been the heart of this church to be on point, up front. Now, that has made some love us and some hate us. It was the religious people who hated Jesus. It was the religious people who killed him. Never forget that. The street, they love Jesus. So I make no apologies. Because we know who we are. We are that woman fighting our way through the crowd to get to Jesus. We are the blind men along the road screaming to Jesus. The leprous individual standing along the road screaming to Jesus. That's who we are. We're blind. We're leprous. We're dying. We know who we are. I pray that we always know who we are. Because if we forget, it's the beginning of the end. The only reason God uses us at all is because of the humility in which we come to Him. We're not special. We just love each other and love Jesus, and we're kind of combat ready. Our doctrine is quite simple, quite orthodox. We believe in the cross and God's grace. But we believe in holiness. We believe in walking the walk, not just talking the talk. Who touched me? Jesus asked. I can't wait to be with him and quiz him about that event. Because I tell you, God has poured out that kind of power upon us over the years. He's done some great stuff. Many of you are evidence to his mercy, his patience. You're all just a bunch of blind people healed, a bunch of lepers healed. So am I. So this week, let that be in the forefront of your mind. That God sent his only son in the body of a flesh and blood baby to come here and live through this snow and cold. Says he was tempted in every way that we were. He experienced temptation just like us, and yet never sinned. He was the pure, unspotted sacrifice, and he paid for all that junk you did. All of it. Even the stuff, even the junk you haven't done yet. That's how much he loves us. May we never forget. Worship team, come forward, please.